I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views. In late February, the controversial founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, appeared in a London court, confined inside a glass box for his extradition hearing. Founded in Iceland in 2006, WikiLeaks gained notoriety and prominence within news media for offering a platform to publish leaked documents provided by whistleblowers. Now the organization's founder, the aforementioned Julian Assange, faces prosecution by the United States government on charges of violating the Espionage Act. The ramifications of Assange's trial has concerned many journalists who feel that the case of Julian Assange and its eventual outcome will have serious implications in regards to press freedom. One of those journalists is Kevin Gustula of Shadowproof, who, as it turns out, was at Julian Assange's extradition hearing. Kevin joins us on this edition of the program to give us not only a first-hand report of the hearing, but also to discuss the case of Julian Assange more broadly and some of the aforementioned implications it could have in regards to freedom of the press. And with that being said, why don't we jump right into the conversation with Kevin Gustula of Shadowproof. Welcome to Parallax Views. Investigative journalist Kevin Gustula of Shadowproof. How are you doing? I hear you just got back from the Julian Assange extradition hearing.
Yeah, I spent the last week covering the Julian Assange proceedings in London.
And we're going to get into that. But first, maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar with Shadowproof, you could tell my listeners a little bit about the work you do with Shadowproof.
Over at shadowproof.com, I do a lot of work covering whistleblowers and whistleblower or leak prosecutions. I cover a lot with secrecy and transparency. And I mean, I've been doing some work particularly on the Democratic presidential primary, just like every other media outlet in the United States does. But my focus is mostly WikiLeaks and whistleblowers. And I have a colleague who I run the website with named Brian Sonnenstein, and he does a lot on prisons and mass incarceration in the United States. So there's a lot of good reporting there on that subject, if any of your listeners would be interested. And so, yeah, this is an independent media organization. We have freelance contributions from people on a fairly regular basis. We like to give platforms to journalists who deserve more recognition for the work that they're doing, and to give freelance journalists work who might be struggling to find a way to get into some of the more established media outlets. And so that's essentially what I do with my website, and I'm really proud of what we've been building. We've been around for about 5 years, and it's going pretty well.
I was going to say, too, you're one of the few outlets that really dug deep into the story of reality winner, the whistleblower, who's sort of been forgotten by the mainstream media, even though you would think she's someone that the Rachel Maddows of the world would be more interested in, given her whistleblowing on alleged Russian interference. And I'm really glad that you guys covered that. That was how I first sort of came into contact with Shadowproof, actually.
Yeah, we did cover that story. And just recently I had the privilege of being invited to go to the University of Michigan and participate in an event that was linked to a fantastic play. So, you know, I'm just going to pitch this because I saw it and I liked it quite a bit. If it happens to come to a college or university in your area, or if you get a chance to see it at a theater in your community, there's a woman who put together this production that's going off the verbatim transcript of the FBI interrogation. There is no original script that was written. They're just using the words from the interrogation to form this play, and then taking some artistic license and adding a lot to it to make it entertaining while watching it performed on a stage. And it's fantastic. It's done very well. So for those of you who don't know about this story, you can go to Shadowproof and find a lot of reporting. But then I do recommend, if you're into this kind of thing and you want to see someone do something creative with it all, if this play comes to your area, you should go see it.
And now, shifting our focus to Assange, I actually heard that you were on Sky News talking about Julian Assange's extradition hearing. And also, I heard through the grapevine that you were on an Australian radio show, which I thought to myself, oh, that must have been awkward, because I know in Australia there's a lot of, you know, just dislike or even contempt for Assange. What has your experience been with media regarding the extradition hearing, though?
I'm overwhelmingly pleased with the kind of response that my work has gotten from media. I haven't done any corporate or establishment media in the United States. That's not surprising, though. They mostly ignore my work. But outside of the U.S., I'm very happy that people at BBC will call me and ask me to go, even if it's just on their late night radio programs. I'm invited to go on and provide rundowns related to the Assange proceedings. And then, as you say, in Australia, I had a couple opportunities, and the most major one being Sky News Australia, because that was on television and broadcast to a global audience. That was a really fantastic interview. I was pleased with how that went. They didn't treat me like a second-class citizen, as often happens with independent journalists. I feel like I got a straight-up opportunity to address the issues and what's at stake, just like anybody else would who was a reporter on the proceedings. So I give them a lot of credit for that interview. They didn't ask me any terrible questions. And even the areas where I think they may have been trying to patronize or play up some part of, like, Julian Assange's appeal to certain supporters, that didn't even bother me. There was one part where a guy said, these people who are supporters, they really like Julian Assange. They'll devote their lives to him, won't they? And I think that that was maybe a mainstream way of saying that we don't really get why people like him so much. But there's a truth to that, because I ran into those people and there's nothing wrong with them. It's great that Julian has those people. They're people who will travel from France and other parts of Europe and even leave the United States and come and go to London, and they'll stand outside, and a lot of those people aren't even going into the courtroom to see Julian Assange and to witness the proceedings, because there's only 16 seats available for the public. So there's a very limited opportunity for anyone outside of the United Kingdom, let alone from this country, to go witness these proceedings, because there's just not a lot of seats for those people. But that interview went very well. I did one on radio, as you mentioned. That guy, before we started, he said, I have to tell you, people just hate Julian Assange. And I don't want to get into that. I don't want to talk about why people hate him. But I just thought you should know that. And I'm going to focus on the issues related to the case. And I just need you to come on my show and help me flesh out some of this, because I think we should share this with people. So I appreciated the way he went about doing that interview. That went well. And that honesty was nice, knowing, like, a recognition that hatred of Assange sometimes gets in the way of the coverage. I think, to me, that was the message I was getting from him, this acknowledgement that sometimes the hatred is actually kind of blinding in the way that they cover and talk about the case.
Well, I was going to say, for my own part, I will say that I've been critical of Julian Assange at times. There's aspects of maybe his story, his life, that give me pause. But at the same time, I think it's important to look at this case lucidly, especially because of the effect it could have on people who publish leaked information.
Yeah. So to the issue of personalities and character flaws and defects, I mean, I have a pretty standard approach as a journalist that I apply to all the cases that I cover, which is that primarily the governments who pursue these people are going to highlight these things and try to get us to turn on these individuals. And that is effective and can be very effective in discouraging people from showing them support when they're being targeted through these. It's a leak prosecution. It's the same treatment he's receiving as the same treatment that they directed at Chelsea Manning, or that they directed at Reality Winner, or that they've directed at John Kiriakou, Thomas Drake, an NSA whistleblower. We can go down the list and name people who have been in the news over the last 20 years who have been prominent leak or whistleblower cases. And that's the same thing that Julian Assange is going through. And I think there are certain parts of Julian's life, certain choices that he's made that we could disagree with. But we also should recognize that some of the things that we're taught to dislike about him are deliberately made to be negative by the government that wants to destroy him and the media organization that he founded. So I think that there are certain things that we're told about him that are intended to prime us in such a way so that when he most needs people to speak up and pay attention to the larger issues, we would be discouraged and we would be silent. I mean, right now what they're doing has a lot of impact, or will have a lot of impact on press freedom if it is successfully carried out.
Well, not the government. I was just
I don't want to get in. Mm-hmm. Well, just if I can finish my point. The thing that I want to say is, We could focus on all of that and go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, not to needle you, but I'm wondering if there's anything specific you're referring to with how the U.S. sort of portrays him.
My key example would be the fact that he's gotten a lot of flack for supposedly cozying up to Russia. And as much as I have my own criticisms of the Russian government and the way that Vladimir Putin runs the government, I think that you have to recognize that if he's doing a show on Russia Today, or if there happen to be sources within Russia who may or may not be connected to the government, he claims that he didn't get the DNC emails from a Russia state actor. And until somebody can prove that he's a liar, I think that, you know, we have to take Julian Assange at his word that that's what is the case when it comes to the sourcing of those emails. I'm talking about the Clinton campaign emails that were published in 2016. But lots of the hatred that we get from Democrats and the intelligence agencies right now is that, you know, WikiLeaks might be some kind of a like operation that had cozied up to the Russian government all just to take on the U.S. government and to act as a kind of like hostile intelligence agency to fight the U.S. and its agenda around the world. And the fact is, he's not an American citizen, and he doesn't have to be. He has no allegiance to the United States, nor should he have to have allegiance to the United States, because he's an Australian. So if someone from Australia wants to say he's disloyal because they have some kind of issue with Russia, and you can be a traitor if you cozy up with Russia, that would be between him and his government. But as far as I can tell, he's free to make choices with any of the countries that we consider enemies, because he's not an American. And this is such a big thing that runs throughout a lot of this case, where it feels like they're imposing these laws on somebody as if he should be an American. But he's not an American. He's somebody who is from a country outside of the United States and shouldn't be expected to abide by our laws, let alone the norms that we impose or feel imposed upon us as Americans on a daily basis.
No, I think you make a good case for that. And also, even if there's things that may make me uncomfortable about Julian Assange, I don't know, there's been a lot of talk of Roger Stone and Julian Assange in the past few years. The thing is, this is about press freedom for me at the end of the day, regardless of what we may personally think of Julian Assange. I think that the leaks he has published are not in question, and I do think they're important.
Yeah, well, the other thing I would add with the Republicans who have talked about and claimed that they've had some interactions with WikiLeaks is that we almost always find out that they've been embellishing or lying about the extent to which they were collaborating with WikiLeaks. I think it's universally recognized now that Roger Stone was lying about what he knew about the Podesta emails or the campaign emails or the DNC emails or whatever emails were going to be available to allegedly or not boost Donald Trump in 2016. And as it turns out, he really didn't have a line to WikiLeaks where he was getting exclusive secret information about what was coming next. And we've had Donald Trump Jr. claim things related to direct messages between the organization. And it just doesn't amount to much. These Republicans who had some kind of passing interest in WikiLeaks, it's always been because they want to extract some kind of political benefit out of WikiLeaks. It's never been because they very like genuinely want to work with the organization and jump on board and help them bring more transparency to governments.
Well, all of that aside, I think the important issue, and I want to bring it back to this, is what does this mean for press freedoms, the extradition of Julian Assange? Because I think that's key. Everything else is sort of almost ancillary to that issue. Yes. of press freedom.
Yeah, so the critical point that has to be focused upon is that we are trying to impose our own secrecy laws on someone who is not a U.S. citizen. And I think the defense attorney in his legal team, his name's Edward Fitzgerald, put it pretty well when I heard him say in the extradition proceedings this last week, how can somebody be accused of committing treason against the United States when they're not a U.S. citizen, when they're not an American. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what Edward Fitzgerald said to the judge. It's just ludicrous that you could do this to a foreigner, and they're seeking to extradite someone and impose a secrecy law, which is the way that our Espionage Act is being prosecuted. The way the Espionage Act is used is as if it's an official secrets act, which the United Kingdom actually has an official secrets act. And so it's to say that he has to abide by that U.S. law and the way the Justice Department has been using it against individuals. And so by doing that, they're giving permission, or they're opening up this can of worms where other countries that have power and influence are going to start to do the same, I believe. I think that if you were China, or if you were Russia, or Israel, or Saudi Arabia, or maybe Turkey, or any other country that had some kind of power and influence continentally or regionally, that you could use your power to try to extradite people who were journalists who published information that you had deemed so sensitive that it could not be published, in order to send a message that you discourage any global correspondent or other independent journalists who work in various different countries, anyone who is involved in politics, any journalist who align themselves with activism, that you could go after and punish and silence those people for being involved in trying to publish information that could force governments to change their policies. And so that's what we're talking about here, is that WikiLeaks has had a very clear agenda of opening up the secrets of governments to the public to force transparency and give populations a means in which that they could challenge corruption within institutions. And because they believe that by doing this, the whole world is going to gradually become a better place with this information. And that is a very basic essence of what WikiLeaks has done. And the government of the United States is criminalizing this by going after Julian Assange. And so in setting this example for the world, because the U.S. is such an influence, it holds itself out as this beacon of the free world. So if the beacon of the free world says that you can do this and extradite somebody from the U.K. for publishing information, then the message becomes clear to other countries that this could be what we do next. I mean, anybody throughout the world, if this case succeeds, would understandably have no reason to be reluctant about pursuing their own kind of extradition of individuals like this.
And I was going to add, I think sometimes people forget all the good work WikiLeaks has done, regardless of what you think of the DNC leaks. They've done so much great work. People don't talk about it anymore, but the collateral murder video. We saw journalists killed in that video of the Baghdad airstrike, and people need to remember that that information was very important.
And even with their editor-in-chief, their former editor-in-chief and founder being in jail, they're still doing work. They're still publishing material today, and it's controversial work, but that's always been the case for WikiLeaks, that they went where a lot of publishers refused to go. So they've been highlighting, and we don't have to get into these specific issues, but just so people understand, they've spent the last year putting themselves out there and trying to advocate and help people better understand what happened around this report on the alleged chemical attack in Douma, Syria, that there were questions about how OPCW conducted their investigation of what happened. And so they've been putting out this reporting because it seems like there was a kind of cover-up around what really happened with this alleged chemical attack. They published the Vault 7 materials from the CIA, which made the CIA very, very angry, but those revealed offensive cyber tools that were being used by the CIA, and the way they were planting malware in TVs. And again, like, it was the kind of thing that we were glad to learn from Edward Snowden, that intelligence services from the United States were doing to our technology. And so they've done that even as Julian Assange was stuck in the embassy in Ecuador. He was subject to an espionage operation, and then also while he's in jail. Like, so in these moments where it was impossible for him to lead the organization, there's still been people outside of just him and his immediate circle, I guess, that have been involved in trying to keep the organization going, even as it is hampered by this prosecution. And as you say, there are all of these publications that made it such a remarkable organization that was deserving of praise, that led to it winning, led to Julian Assange winning journalism prizes, led to human rights organizations praising the effect of what was published, especially when it came to how this information was useful to people in Northern African countries like Tunisia and Egypt around the uprisings, which was called the Arab Spring, more generally speaking. And so, I mean, I don't downplay the DNC emails or any of that stuff that was put out by WikiLeaks, because I think that's crucially important. We're seeing right now why it's good to have all of that information available, because we can almost anticipate what the Democratic National Committee and these establishment candidates are going to do next against Bernie Sanders. And that's a pretty objective statement without going off on a tangent and digging into the Democratic primary and talking about a subject that we weren't planning to get into. It's just an objective fact that that information gives us an example of how the party apparatus works during a presidential election. So a lot of people who are at the grassroots level can anticipate what might happen next, and they can be on guard for what will happen so that we can protect democracy to the most extent possible in this 2020 primary. So that's useful for people who are progressives. It's very useful to people who are engaged and, you know, oppose the money influence the outcome of politics to such a degree. And anyway, I'll just quickly make sure people recognize, in case there was any question in any of your listeners' minds, that this indictment only covers 2010 and 2011. It does not involve anything else that WikiLeaks ever did. The Julian Assange is facing punishment for the disclosures from Chelsea Manning, for publishing these disclosures that came from this U.S. Army whistleblower, which, you know, she's been well known now for the last decade. And this material is the collateral murder video. It's the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs. It's the diplomatic cables. It's Guantanamo detainee files. It's also a rules of engagement document that provided context for the collateral murder video to help people see that they, in fact, you know, were committing a war crime when they were killed the Reuters journalist. So this is all important information that's been out there. And I'll say the one thing that I really appreciated about the extradition proceedings when the defense was presenting their own legal arguments was that they did take the time to ensure that the judge had some understanding of what this material was, in case she's new to this and maybe has never really dug into these releases and maybe didn't know about what WikiLeaks had done in the past. They gave her a very basic education that, you know, for example, like this, these were the cables. And here are some examples. It revealed that the United States was encouraging their own diplomats to spy on people at the UN. Okay, and then here's another example. It also revealed that the US was having the Yemen government cover up drone strikes in Yemen and say that they were the ones that were carrying them out and it wasn't the United States. And so going down the list and giving examples of things. In Iraq, there was the example of this order that the military had to deny that they had any knowledge that the Iraqi security forces were involved in torture so that they could basically wash their hands of it and not be responsible for any crimes there in the war. So this is important that the judge is being educated on the context in which Julian Assange took these actions, because the outcomes were very useful. Our education, our collective education, we're so much more informed than we would be without a lot of these documents.
And I'm glad we set the groundwork for this, because I do want to talk about the actual extradition hearing and your experience there. But real quickly, I want to mention two quotes. One of them's actually mentioned in one of your recent pieces for Shadowproof. But the first is Edward Snowden. And Edward Snowden has been critical of Assange at times. But when Snowden commented on the arrest of Assange, he said in no uncertain terms, "This is a dark moment for press freedom." And I think that's important to consider, especially coming from Edward Snowden. I think he has a very good point there. The other quote, as you mentioned in your first piece on the Assange extradition hearing, is from 2013, and it's from the Justice Department spokesperson Matthew Miller, speaking about the decision under President Obama to not indict Assange. He said, "If you are not going to prosecute journalists for publishing classified information, which the department is not, then there is no way to prosecute Assange." That is in 2013, and I think it's something worth considering, because we're in a whole new ballgame, it seems like, now.
Yeah, and so as we've laid the groundwork, I want to lay one last piece before we get specifically into the extradition hearing. Not a lot of people know this, but just so people are aware, there's always this issue of, is Assange a journalist or is he not? Is he a publisher? Is he an activist? Is he a hacker? Okay, fact is, he actually has a press card from the International Federation of Journalists. And since 2010, he's been a member of the Media, Entertainment, and Arts Alliance, which is this trade union in Australia. So he's a journalist. In order to be a member, you typically have to pay dues to be part of these organizations. So he's a journalist, and he should be entitled to protections that journalists have. And so what Matthew Miller is saying is crucial, because this is a big part of the defense's argument. And you can dig into this as far as you want to, but the basic point here is Donald Trump politicized this case to a degree that did not exist in the Obama administration. Now, that might be tough for people who listen to your show who understand that Obama waged a war on whistleblowers, but he actually stopped. His Justice Department stopped at the line. They didn't cross it. They went right up to the line. They considered crossing it, and then they didn't. And they backed away. And they backed away because of what Matthew Miller was talking about. And so there is one negative thing that I can say about the Obama administration and its legacy, which is that they didn't completely shut down the grand jury investigation into WikiLeaks, which made it possible for Donald Trump to just basically awaken it from dormancy and bring it back. And that's why Chelsea Manning is in a jail cell right now. That's why Jeremy Hammond, who is the convicted person involved in the Stratfor hack, these were leaked materials that WikiLeaks published, and he's in jail, she's in jail. They're both in jail for refusing to testify before this grand jury in Alexandria. And he could have shut that down. He could have made a big announcement and said, "We're done with this. We're shutting it down." And that would have had an effect on preventing Trump from bringing these cases forward, I believe. Although they probably could still open them, you would have had that clear mark right there in the sand that they had put a stop to this. So this case, one thing the prosecutors have going for it is you could claim technically that they didn't really end the investigation because the grand jury wasn't shut down. And the prosecutor did say as much while I was in London. So there's that, and that's a big deal, because the Trump administration, instead of staying with what Obama did, Jeff Sessions, you have to remember, was the attorney general, and he has a passionate dislike for leaks. And also Donald Trump shares that as well. We've heard him talk openly in public about wanting to vengefully go after people who leak against his own administration. And he's even used words that create imagery of hanging people up in the square and having public hangings and stuff like that. So this shows you the intensity in which the Justice Department has permission to go after not just people who leak, but the journalists who are publishing. And I think this is kind of a test case when you think about it. This is Donald Trump's administration, people in it seeing that if they could get this one case on the books and successfully prosecute it, then they'll be able to go after other individuals. And it also will be useful. Like, there's got to be people within our intelligence agencies who see this as tremendously useful to pushing back against the way in which journalism has been moving things in the other direction for the last 15 to 20 years. Because effectively, we've been shifting the culture and changing people's minds about what should be kept secret and what should not be kept secret. And so by convicting Assange, you get a case on the books that can help them push it back towards secrecy rather than in the direction of transparency.
We'll come back to Trump, but one more thing, and it just crossed my mind. I guess prosecutors have alleged in this case that Assange helped Manning crack an encrypted password. Do you have any insight into that claim and maybe pushing back on it?
Well, I can tell you that that claim is going to be very, very difficult for the prosecutors to prove because they do not have the evidence to back it up, in my opinion. And what we heard in court was that Chelsea Manning had quite the interest in being able to crack passwords, that she was even at one point considering starting a business where she could actually like make a living off of helping people crack passwords or like work with, I don't know how you would formalize this, but she was very into this. And I think the question that came up in the chat about hash tables, and I'm not a very technical person, but so we'll just keep it very vague that she was asking about decryption and decrypting hash values. And I think that came up because she wanted to pick Julian Assange's brain since he's this well-known hacker and had been, and even was prosecuted in Australia or even had a criminal case in Australia prior to WikiLeaks. And so she knew who he was and probably thought he could offer some information and help him. But at the time, we also heard that in the secure facility where she worked, her computer was re-imaged a few days before she had that chat with Julian Assange. And so she may have been interested in getting some help from him to crack a password on her computer so she could put music, movies, and her own software that was unauthorized back on her computer without her superior officers knowing about it. This was something that was very common in the secure facility. We heard about this during the court-martial, and it was used as mitigating evidence to show that Chelsea Manning had a lot of things on her computer that were unauthorized, but so did all of her fellow officers who she was working with as an intelligence analyst. And she even had her own superior officer ask her for help to put a piece of software on her computer and to crack into it and put it on in an unauthorized manner. So she had her superior ask her to commit a code violation, as in she could have been in trouble for doing this if she got caught. And so this was the sort of activity, the way people conducted themselves in this facility. And I think it's more likely that that explains that part of the chat than that she needed to get anonymous access to the material because she already had access. And the other thing that we're hearing in court is evidence that a lot of these databases she was going to didn't require a login or a password to get to. The way that the U.S. military tracked people who were going to bring up these the way they tracked people who were accessing these databases was through their internet protocol addresses or their IP addresses. So like they could tell through the IP address that certain people, like certain computers, were logging in to the databases, but that didn't necessarily mean that they knew who the actual person or user was that was accessing the database.
And bringing this back around to Trump, you mentioned Trump's failings on leaks. I also think it's worth noting that Secretary of State under Trump, Mike Pompeo, has said WikiLeaks is a non-state hostile intelligence agency, and he has added that Assange has no First Amendment rights. I think this flies in the face of the narrative that the Trump administration is on Assange's side. There's this idea that floated around after the DNC leaks that Assange was looking for a pardon from Trump. And I, you know, to put it bluntly, I don't think there's a snowball's chance in hell of Trump giving him any kind of pardon, it seems like, at this point.
That did actually come up during the proceedings, this thing of the pardon. I don't know if your listeners are going to remember that there's been some news stories out there about a meeting that happened in 2017 when Republican Congressman Dana Rohrabacher met with Julian Assange along with a far-right activist journalist named Chuck Johnson, who met with him. And they had this meeting, and I'm told that that the people in the U.S. government were actually panicked because they thought that something was happening with Trump making some overture, and it seemed like he didn't consult anybody in the intelligence agencies about this before going forward. This is kind of like rogue, on-the-fly type thing that Donald Trump has been known for doing without consulting other people, and that there was an offer that was going to be made. But what really happened is that he was using the threat of prosecution to try to extort some kind of political benefit from Julian Assange. And what he wanted Julian to do is to help him combat all of the criticism he was getting around Russiagate, to say very clearly that the source of the DNC emails was not from Russian intelligence, and to give information publicly that would be useful to him. I mean, the problem is that Julian had already said himself pretty soon after the publication that it did not come from a Russia state actor. So what Trump was asking Julian Assange to do as a journalist was to compromise his confidential sources. So he had a dilemma. If he gave information to Trump about the way in which he did his journalism, he'd be compromising his integrity. But then he might also be able to leave the embassy and get a deal if he believed Trump. But you also could maybe be doubtful about Trump because you weren't sure that he could actually get this deal when the Justice Department was prosecuting. You'd need to have some kind of evidence that the Justice Department was going to seize targeting him for prosecution. So we heard about this, and I agree with you that I don't think Trump is a serious person who wants to actually offer Julian Assange a pardon. I think that's beyond the realm of any sort of possibility. I can't imagine that he sees any. It was useful when he was running against Hillary Clinton to talk about WikiLeaks, but beyond that, it's outlived its value. And like anything with Trump, once it's no longer useful to him personally, he no longer needs to have anything to do with you or with the thing that was helpful.
I was going to say, we see the same thing with Reality Winner. I was talking to Billy Winner Davis about this some months back, and I talked to her and said, didn't Trump say that Reality Winner is getting the shaft? Why doesn't he give her a pardon if he really thinks that? Because he brought her up in one of his rallies or one of his speeches. He said, oh, she's being so mistreated. And yet he hasn't done anything for her. Same story with Assange.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's just usually to make a political point that will be supported by or cheered on by the MAGA, the Make America Great Again people, his supporters, his own personal supporters, who will go, yeah, lock her up. And so it's not like we should take anything that he's doing all that seriously, and we should see it as an abuse of authority. And that's why I bring up this whole interlude here of allegedly offering some kind of a pardon to Assange, because he's trying to extort Julian Assange to give him something. And it shows you that if they can do that, they're not very serious, that the Justice Department does not really have to prosecute this case. They could abandon it and all would be well, because if you can bargain and do a deal, then it's not like you need to bring this person to justice for these crimes. And then it shows you that this is elective. And this is a choice. It's a political decision to go after Julian Assange.
Another thing that I found very interesting was that the defense for Assange spoke of a Spanish security company called Undercover Global, which was contracted by Sheldon Adelson, who is one of the billionaires that has been Trump's most generous donors. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how this organization played into the defense.
And I have to say that this has really flown under the radar here in the United States. It should be a huge story. And the evidence that we have suggests that the CIA was backing this mercenary who was running this security company in Spain and tasked him with training all of his equipment on the Ecuador embassy under the guise of security, that they were going to go in and for the Ecuador government, they were going to secure the embassy. But by secure, we really mean he was going to plant microphones all over the embassy that would upload recordings, that would and then there would be devices around that could snap video. You know, they have photos of people there who were meeting with Assange. So all of this material could be uploaded to servers that could then be accessed by the CIA, and they could use this material to try and ramp up this pressure campaign to expel Julian Assange from the embassy, and to also make sure that they weren't outmaneuvered by Assange and his legal team as they sought ways that they could free Julian Assange from the embassy. Like, for example, they were thinking of, well, he did get diplomatic status in December 2017. And then the defense's argument is that they panicked. And that was when the Justice Department issued their first indictment against Julian Assange for allegedly conspiring with Chelsea Manning to hack into a military computer. So that's, I give that as background. The specific allegation here is that David Morales came to Las Vegas. He's the owner of UC Global, and that he met with Sheldon Adelson in Las Vegas at a security trade fair, or he met with someone representing Adelson, and he got this contract to do security for his private yacht. And also while he was in the U.S., on the side, he was able to ink a contract with U.S. intelligence agencies. And so then he went back to Spain, and he was able to conduct this operation now. And it really went far afield. It got away from him. At a certain point, employees realized that he was losing sense of what was acceptable. He was willing to cross certain lines that people in his company were not willing to cross. And we started hearing conversations about, if you believe these whistleblowers, they started hearing conversations about kidnapping Julian Assange, snatching him from the embassy, like, for example, leaving the door standing wide open and someone could just go in there and grab him. You know, you wouldn't know why the door was left open. It would be like, oops, innocent mistake. We should have shut the door. But someone could come in and snatch Julian Assange. They talked about poisoning Julian Assange. There were these scenarios that were thought up among people in the company that could help the CIA or help U.S. government get their hands on Julian Assange. So he really wanted him to leave the embassy.
And what is the importance of Manning, who we mentioned earlier, to the prosecution and the defense in this extradition hearing?
The importance is that she has a timeline that she says things unfolded along, which does not match what they have to argue in their case. So if I'm being very blunt, theirs are lies and hers are facts. And because they haven't been able to discredit her, they now have to deal with trying to force people to believe, or they have to fudge the details so that people will buy their timeline. I mean, their timeline of events is that Chelsea Manning got recruited by Julian Assange to be an insider or spy who would then go into military computers and steal documents for WikiLeaks that could be published. Her timeline is, I had access to this material all along. And as I was working with this, I became interested in these different sets of documents. And I knew about WikiLeaks, but You know, the other thing that the government has to overcome is she didn't go to WikiLeaks first. She actually went to the New York Times and called them up, or she then tried to get a meeting with people at the Washington Post. So she wasn't always going to disclose her information to Julian Assange. So if she's working for Julian Assange, why would she want to give the information she was going to take to these other media outlets, which you would have to say were competitors? They were alternatives to WikiLeaks, at least. And they want to claim that she saw a list that was on WikiLeaks' website that most people don't know anything about, but we're going to hear a lot about it in this case, which is called the Most Wanted Leaks List, and it's from 2009. And it was really a wiki list. It was something that was populated by activists, human rights organizations, lawyers, and other journalists who basically said, these are documents we think governments should make public. We think if they are being transparent, we should get to see what these documents are. And so this is the wish list. These are the things that we should fight for these governments to release. And if any sources have access to these materials, we would publish them because they're in the public interest. And so WikiLeaks didn't create this list per se. It was a lot of different people, but they promoted this list. And because it has the WikiLeaks stamp on it, the government says that this list became a roadmap for Chelsea Manning in selecting documents. But the problem with that is there's only like one thing that is on that list that she disclosed to WikiLeaks, which is the rules of engagement for Iraq. And that came out because she needed to send something to WikiLeaks for context with the collateral murder video. And so what you won't find on the list are the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs. You won't find the diplomatic cables there. You won't find the collateral murder video there. You won't find the Guantanamo detainee files there. And so it doesn't make sense that this would be the guide that she was using to select things to be released. I mean, there's listed databases there that WikiLeaks wanted to have if you believe that this was the list that was supposed to do that for sources, and she didn't give them those materials. She's giving them a bunch of information that WikiLeaks doesn't want, and she's not giving them information that the prosecutors say WikiLeaks wants. So it doesn't make any sense for them to put the two together and say that there's a connection.
And I was going to add to all of that that there's been a lot of attacks on Assange, but I haven't seen that nearly as much with Manning. In ways, I think Manning has been ignored even more than Assange. And I think at the grassroots level, even people I know that may be critical of Assange, they have no dislike for Manning. They trust Manning in general. And I think that's very relevant to all of this. I don't think Manning is really in question with most people and most activists at all.
I'd agree with that. And I think that what she's going through, unfortunately, flies beneath this extradition proceeding because it's a side thing. But it's important to follow, and it's important to report on, as I've done, what she's going through and the fight that she is waging to maintain her resistance and then also end what she is enduring, which is she should no longer be in jail and she should no longer be fined. She's being fined about $1,000 every single day that she's in this jail because she will not testify before this grand jury. And it's a grand jury that, let's just be clear, is set up to destroy this media organization. That's the whole point of this grand jury conducting their investigation. It has no other basis for existing other than to stop WikiLeaks from being able to operate. That's how it's been for the last decade. That's what the U.S. government and its agenda has been in order to shut this WikiLeaks organization down and make it completely inoperable so that it no longer is the thorn in the side of U.S. superpower that it's been for the last 10 years. So that's what is going on with this. And unfortunately, Chelsea Manning, because she's competing against this case with such high stakes, she gets overlooked, unfortunately, although we had some important developments in the last couple of weeks where she put forward a new challenge to try and force her release. And her lawyers, what they're raising is very alarming, which is that they're very fearful that she's become institutionalized and so used to being in this jail, and that she feels such a burden to live up to her reputation as a kind of international hero to everyone in fighting for freedom and human rights against the United States, that she's actually doing great damage to her health because she won't leave the jail cell, that there's no way in which she can leave the jail cell unless the government frees her.
Is she still being held in isolation? That's what I was hearing in 2019, that she was being held in isolation for long periods.
I don't think she ever really was held in isolation. I mean, she's been in general population for, I think there might have been a month or two there where she was in harsh conditions. Mm-hmm. But I think we learned that some of that had to do with the protocol for handling new high-profile prisoners in the facility. And again, I'm not saying that like people deserve to be abused, but even she's actually in the same facility that Paul Manafort was held in before he was convicted. And I think their lawyers complained as well. And it's also the facility where Maria Butina was, who is this high-profile case where she just got deported back to Russia. So this facility is a one where usually pretrial detainees would be held, and is not meant for someone to be there for a long term. I think that's important because she's not getting the kind of health care she needs. She's a transgender person and she's not getting the treatment she needs for herself. And that's a huge deal. If we want to talk about Chelsea Manning's well-being, that's a huge issue. And who knows when she leaves the jail, what she's going to have to deal with in terms of trying to fix herself because of the lack of care she's been receiving. And the other thing that is really sad to me is in the last months, her mother died and she wasn't able to be at her mom's funeral. And her mom was living in Wales in the UK. And, the prison or the jail obviously wasn't going to make some kind of an arrangement where she could travel and be at her mom's funeral. And so because they would maybe understandably think that she would stay in the UK and not come back to the United States. And so unfortunately, that happens. And because she's going through this, she's not able to be there with her family.
I want to touch on briefly before we discuss your personal experience at the hearing, the third article you wrote about the hearing. US-UK treaty does not apply to Assange extradition, prosecution says. Maybe you could just tell my listeners a little bit about this US-UK treaty and the prosecution's argument about it.
Yeah, essentially, without getting into the weeds too deeply, what people need to understand is the prosecutors are making a very technical argument, which we probably could understand because we know that the United States doesn't feel like it has to follow international law. It feels like our own laws can trump international laws and we can do our own sort of things regardless of what is accepted worldwide. You know, we don't want people who are our soldiers to be prosecuted for war crimes, even when there are certain conventions and human rights laws that say that our soldiers should probably be prosecuted for those war crimes. And the same applies in this case, because in the UK, they have a treaty. It's a treaty that was inked in 2003, and it came into force in the US, I want to say, in 2004. It was something that was ratified in the UK in 2007. While this was all happening, they passed their own domestic law in 2004 was when that went into force, I believe. So this law, they're trying to treat as completely separate from the treaty. So if you follow that, then there is within the domestic law, there's no mention of something called the political offense exception. But in the US-UK treaty that we established, there is mention of the political offense exception. what a political offense exception is a universal thing that has been accepted and is a part of these extradition treaties throughout the world. And it says that you don't extradite people who are involved in political struggles or who are like activists or dissidents that are fighting against their state governments. So a really easy to understand cultural example would be in China, if you have somebody who has maybe been speaking out against their government, against the Chinese government, and they flee and they end up in, let's say, Turkey. Turkey faces an extradition to China. Turkey may deny extradition because of political offense. Like they say, that's, you're trying to extradite this person because you say they committed a crime that was against the interests of the Chinese state government. So that's not a crime here in Turkey, so we're not going to extradite you. Or maybe they would do this in Iraq or Iran or India or some other place. You know what I'm saying? So it is not a universally accepted crime. And a lot of these kinds of crimes that are considered to have exceptions are treason, sedition, or espionage offenses are seen historically as being covered by this political offense exception. But because it's not mentioned in the UK law, the prosecutor is using this technicality to say that the judge should just focus on domestic law and approve the extradition without saying that Julian Assange is covered by it. Because he's charged with a crime under the Espionage Act. He's being prosecuted as if he committed espionage. And so it is a political crime. It's just the way that you look at the indictment is political. He's accused of a political offense. But this technicality is being used to give the judge an out to approve this extradition. And I don't think that that's actually reasonable. It's not really a fair way to go about this, because the entire reason that the United States can pursue the extradition from the United Kingdom of Assange is because they have a treaty. If they didn't have a treaty, they wouldn't have a basis to pursue this request.
And if we could, I want to get into your personal experiences at the extradition hearing. It sounds like it would have been really surreal. I mean, you have Assange on orders from Judge Vanessa Beritzer, maybe mispronouncing her name there, but nonetheless, Assange is being held in a glass box. It sounds like this whole experience would have been really surreal to watch unfold, even before you get into the media annex where you covered this. It sounds like the courthouse, outside the courthouse, the amount of activists and whatnot, it just sounds like a really surreal experience.
There's definitely a spectacle element to it. I mean, there's a lot of people, as I mentioned early in this show, that there's a lot of supporters who traveled to be there to back Julian Assange. Have you heard of the Yellow Vests from France?
Yes,
at all?
Yes.
And so there's those people, and I don't know how to pronounce their official name, but more commonly people understand they're the Yellow Vests, and they've come to the UK multiple times now to show support for Assange. So they're there. And so then when you're inside, yes, the thing that is very clear is that Assange is going through a lot of stress. The glass box really brings home how he is being excluded from being able to participate in his defense. And it's something that I've had to really struggle with, I'll admit, because it's this really odd thing where the United States is doing something supremely wrong in pursuing this extradition and bringing this case against Assange. And yet the prosecutor has no problem with Julian Assange sitting with his attorneys and being allowed out of the glass box. And I've had people suggest to me that maybe that might be some kind of brinksmanship or gamesmanship to maybe take some edge off the way that people dislike that the U.S. is pursuing this case, that maybe it's manipulative, maybe in the back room, they talked to the judge and said, deny it, but in court openly we're going to say that we're neutral and we'll allow Julian Assange to sit with his attorneys if the defense has persuasive enough arguments. But the fact is, we just don't do this in the United States. Everyone who is a defendant gets to sit with their legal team. Even terrorists, people who are accused of terrorism crimes, they get to sit with their attorneys. We don't put anybody in like a glass box and exclude them. But this is a thing that is done in many courts in the United Kingdom. And it's not a thing that has always existed in British courts. It started to become predominant in the 1980s. And the form that we see it in right now, the way it looks, became popular around 2000. So there are precedents that allow somebody out of this glass box, even if they start in it. There are precedents for the judge making a ruling that allows a person out of it so that they can hear, because you struggle, like you're behind this partition and you're having trouble hearing what is going on in the proceedings. And like at one time, the judge gave him a pair of headphones to wear, but it just made it worse because you're getting all this ambient noise that isn't even a part of, like, it's getting in the way of hearing the argument that the defense or the prosecutor is making.
Just the acoustics of the room?
So it's pointless to have this headset on your – and if you're going through this – like if you're having the kind of psychological duress that Assange has been experiencing, it's just going to aggravate your mental issues even more to have all this extra noise. So he just took them off. He tried them for like maybe 20 or so minutes, and he just took them off because it was pointless to wear these. And it also wasn't the issue. The issue that he's trying to overcome is that there's no way for him to participate in his defense. He wants to be able to consult with his attorneys on a regular basis, and he's been denied constantly the access to his legal team. And no matter how many times he's complained with the judge has proposed very weak solutions that don't solve the issue, and he should be able to pass notes to them, but when he wants to pass a note, they can't see him. The glass box is actually directly behind the defense, so they can't actually see when he's signaling them. It's most of the time it's the judge who would see him and then would say something because she acknowledges that he's raising his hand or like he's signaling that he's tired or something. So there's a lot of dysfunction. It's impractical. If you want to have the proceedings go smoothly, you would allow him out of the glass box, but she's just such a stickler and doesn't want to change the security procedure because Mr. Assange demanded it, that she's keeping him there. And there are multiple human rights organizations and press freedom organizations that very adamantly believe that this is a human rights violation, what is unfolding.
And also, he's being surrounded by security guards and representatives of the U.S. government while he's in this glass box, is my understanding?
Yeah, the way that I reported it out is that he's got two security guards that are in the box. So he's got one on the left and the right that are fairly close to him. He gets some space, but not a whole lot of space. And then throughout the courtroom, you have U.S. government representatives. He claimed to be able to represent – he claimed to see people who were – at one point or another in the embassy while he was living in the embassy. So he's concerned about that, because if he's saying something privately to his attorneys, they might know what he's talking about. He could pass it on to people. They could pass that confidential information on to people. There are microphones in the courtroom. And if you're following along at home, you know, we just talked about an espionage operation earlier in this discussion.
Right, Undercover Global, yeah.
Yeah, and it involved microphones, and he's worried that one of these microphones might actually have, like, recording on it, where the intelligence agencies might be keeping any audio that they pick up from the courtroom that could be useful to the case. And this may sound like the stuff of paranoia, but I really have to stress that it's not, because they're like, each time he's been concerned that this has happened, it has turned out to be the truth that it has happened. Like, he was going into the women's bathroom to have meetings with his attorneys because he was paranoid and believed that he was being spied upon. And it turned out he was exactly right. And in fact, they had planted a microphone in the women's bathroom to capture the exchanges that were happening that should be confidential between him and his attorneys. And so if you tell me that it's impossible that a microphone could be picking up the picking up these conversations and passing it on to intelligence, well, I'm going to need to see like a statement from some kind of representative, or I'm going to need to hear a statement from a prosecutor where he specifically and explicitly says that this is not happening in order for me to even begin to believe you, because this has happened before. It's actually happened in the Guantanamo the military tribunal cases, in the cases that have gone on for like 20 years now against alleged 9/11 terrorism suspects, that those defense attorneys have been eavesdropped upon and spied on by the CIA, that there have been microphones that have been sending those feeds into other locations so that agents could have that information. So it could very well be that there's something set up in that courtroom. We just don't know. I mean, even the judge is – she's such a newbie. We don't know a lot about her, and she doesn't have a public profile. But the most important thing is she's very new to this, and she's completely in over her head, and she wouldn't know if anything like that was happening, nor would she probably demand to have answers because she's new to being part of this magistrate court.
Well, I know you mentioned paranoia, but it seems paranoid that he's being put behind a glass box. But at the same time, maybe I'm losing something in translation, because I know in the U.S. there isn't the defendants aren't held behind a security dock. Maybe things are different in the U.K., or is this all unusual there as well?
They've had people who complain about this, and there is a movement to end this practice, as I understand it, because of the fact that it undermines a basic right that you should have a presumption of innocence. I mean, if you're putting somebody in a glass box, I mean, it's easy to look at them and think, oh, they might be a criminal. They're in a glass box. So, like, it has an impact on juries. It has an impact on decision makers and the way that they handle these cases, because you start thinking that person must be dangerous if they're in the glass box. It impairs their ability to have a fair trial and participate in their case. So there are efforts to end this practice because it's just not what most societies that are open, fair, and free would do with individuals. I think that's fair to say.
But this is standard practice within the UK, or?
Yeah, yes. Okay. Yeah, a lot of courts, and this court particularly, is an anti-terrorism courthouse. And so, you know, maybe they're figuring that, okay, we have this here, and, you know, this is where Julian Assange would go. And, like, to some degree, he has been prosecuted and treated as if he is a terrorist. That's true. Just for your listeners, in one single day, the first day of proceedings, we heard later from his defense attorneys that he was strip searched twice, that he was handcuffed 10 or 11 times, that he was moved around to 5 different holding cells in the course of that day, and that he had his papers taken from him, the legal papers, like the documents that he has, so he can follow along with what his attorneys are doing. And so, like, that to me, that's how a terrorist would be treated in that courthouse.
I find it hard to imagine Julian Assange being, you know, physically threatening or violent to anyone, to be honest.
Yeah, and we all saw him carted out of the embassy. That didn't look like a threatening individual. That looked like somebody who needed medical treatment.
Well, that brings me to sort of one of the burning questions I had. Now, were you able to see Assange? Because I know you're in the media annex, so you weren't actually able to hear everything Assange said because of that, which is another issue entirely. I think we should be able to hear everything Assange has said, and that if you're a journalist, you know, that should be vital, the ability to hear what the defense has to say. But I'm just curious, were you able to see Assange from where you were at in the courthouse? What did he look like? I mean, I hear he looks very sickly these days.
Well, most people say he looks unwell, and I can't really judge too much, but I think it's fair to say, based on the way that he behaves, that to a certain degree, he's lost a lot of his ability to focus and stick with things in the same way that he used to be. I mean, even he would say that he's lost a lot of his ability to concentrate.
Is he very erratic, in other words?
I don't know if erratic would be the right word, although I suppose it could apply. But what I'll say is, as the day progresses, he gets tired very quickly.
I see.
And you can just tell by, I mean, I was talking to a colleague, and they said, look, you can watch day to day to day as the week progressed. Each time he comes in the morning, you can tell that he has less and less energy, and he's going to make it. It's going to be harder each day to make it through all of the proceedings. And it's the stamina. It's the fact that it takes such a toll on you to just keep being brought in court every single day. And then, so coming up in May and June, we're going to have a 3-week hearing where witnesses are called to the stand. There's going to be a lot of evidence. It's going to be heavy and intense. He's going to hear things and probably remember certain aspects and details and want to be sure that his defense raises certain points. But the toll that all of this takes cumulatively, that might impair his ability to, you know, go, oh, okay, hey, you need to mention that that individual was in the embassy with me and I asked him about a microphone, or I asked him if they were spying on me and they said no, or, you know, like those kinds of examples. I'm just hypothetically saying things that would be valuable, or like, oh, by the way, that thing that that person just said, that's totally a lie. I can prove to you it's a lie and you should ask him about this and like feed that to his attorney. But if you're mind is completely wiped and you are struggling to stay awake, well, not awake, but if you're struggling to stay with what is happening, you just withdraw and you'll no longer care what's happening in the courtroom, and then you're giving up your ability to participate in your own trial and in your own defense, and that doesn't work out so well for you, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, even before all of this, I assume there was a toll taken just from being in that embassy so long and just basically shut out from the world. Am I correct to say that there were issues with being able to hear Assange in the annex area that you were in?
He's not mic'd, so we can't really pick up his audio. So the reporting that we have on what Assange said comes from the public gallery and the journalists who were there. He's pretty close to a press box where people are sitting. I'll do this before we wrap. I'll lay out the courtroom for people so they know how things are set up. You have the judge on one end of the courtroom, and just think of it like a typical U.S. courtroom. You know, she's raised up and sitting, and then directly across the room in the back is that glass box that we're talking about that Julian Assange sits in. And then we'll do it from the vantage point of the judge. On the left, you have the public gallery, and that's raised up. It's on a second floor, so they're not on the same plane as the prosecutor and the defense. And then the press is a little bit raised above, and they're in a box. And there is also a jury box. So there's a box area where journalists can sit. And then, because we're not going to be having a jury, you can also put journalists in the jury box so that they have seats to cover proceedings. And on the floor, they actually call that the well, and the well has seats for people from the prosecution and the defense side. And so there's the bench table at the front where – and it's all one long table, and you have the prosecution on the left and then the defense on the right, and they're there. And then they get to have their people. And there's a row of people who are part of the defense team that are in front of Julian Assange. So theoretically, they can exchange notes between them, but they would have to know that Assange is signaling them in order to turn behind. But that gives you a sense of how the courtroom looks. And I can see all of that from the media annex. And, you know, this upcoming hearing, I will be in the courtroom, but I also like to be in the media annex just so I can do I feel there's more flexibility to do reporting in real time and to digest it in real time because I'm able to talk with people, and that might be disruptive in court if I was in the courtroom. So maybe I lose a little bit. Maybe I lose being able to fully grasp the mood and the tension and what's happening in the mood in the room. But I'm pretty good. Like, I've been following this stuff for 6 or 7 years. I'm pretty good at sensing what's going on. And I can tell when things are getting testy, even in a UK court, when there's a lot of formality and politeness, you can tell when that's just a facade and you're really, things are starting to escalate and get tense.
Wrapping up here, what was the general mood, maybe some thoughts that people were having, specifically activists and the journalists who were around regarding this extradition hearing and Julian Assange's case in general?
So I would say that most people immediately jump to, and I bet your listeners are there with us as well, is this judge going to rule on this and approve the extradition? I mean, immediately people are jumping ahead and asking, so does this, did how things go, does this mean that Julian Assange is going to probably be extradited? Is there anything we can get from this past week that indicates she's going to approve the extradition? And I don't know that the defense had a lot go their way to where after this first week they're feeling like things are going to turn out okay for Assange at this stage. I think there was some combativeness from the judge when it came to the defense presenting their argument. And so the takeaway that I had was, you know, I think she's rather receptive to the prosecutors, and it doesn't look so great for Assange. That might change after 3 weeks of witnesses, but she's not very – she doesn't come off as the most impartial judge that I've ever watched. I think that Denise Lind, who was the military judge in Chelsea Manning's case, was far better at being an impartial judge than this judge. And so – and then that was even me recognizing that she's institutionally a military judge and she's going to dislike everything about what – she's hearing about Chelsea Manning, and she's going to really believe that, you know, we can't let this go. You need to pay the price for what you did, Chelsea Manning. But still, there was a way that Denise Lind managed that military courtroom. And I didn't see the same thing from Vanessa Beretzer, this judge. So I think going forward, most people were thinking of, okay, so lose this round. What happens next round? People should know that there's 3 or 4 levels potentially that this could go to. You have the high court after this, after the magistrate court. You have an appeal court, and then you have a Supreme Court. And depending on what happens with Brexit, there may or may not be a European Court of Human Rights that he can go to. And all the attorneys are pretty sure that if they go to the European Court of Human Rights, they would ultimately win. They would defeat the extradition, and this would be over. But if Boris Johnson, who's the Prime Minister of the UK, decides to fully withdraw if the Brexit includes leaving the European court, then they're in trouble because all they have is the Supreme Court in the UK.
It sounds like, too, that for the extradition hearing, the courthouse where this all took place was not necessarily equipped to handle this. I mean, Assange is a celebrity at this point. It sounds like they weren't equipped to handle this. I mean, I know the judge was complaining about noise outside the courthouse from demonstrators. It sounds like it was a real mess in a lot of ways.
Well, that's the issue, is that the security gate is pretty close to this courtroom. So I know that you have to respect people's freedom of speech and assembly, and you want them to be able to demonstrate where people are going to see them and know that they're demonstrating against this case. But I will say that along the way during the week, there was a mutual understanding worked out between supporters and journalists that while court was in session, you would not chant so that we can cover and report on the proceedings, because it was affecting the ability for us to actually get the information we needed and to pass it on to the world, because not everyone's – obviously 99.9% of the world is not really at this proceeding. So they're relying on us to pass on this information, and if we don't get it – and you know, once they say it, it's gone. And then if we want to go back and get it, we have to go through the cumbersome task of how do we get a transcript? Is there even a transcript? Can we get video? Can we get the video recording? And can we have that? Well, okay, sure. But then you have to spend hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to get it. So obviously an independent journalist isn't going to do that. Will the Associated Press or NBC News cough up money for that? Probably not. So then it's just gone. We don't have it. So it's really important that we were able to work out some kind of an understanding with the Assange supporters that while court was in session, you could not chant. And then when we're not in session, you can do all the chanting you want for Julian Assange.
Well, hey, Kevin Gastula of Shadowproof, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Maybe you could throw out some information for how people can follow your work. And also, I always like to end on a positive note. I think the positive note for me was reading that Noam Chomsky submitted an expert testimony that was very much pointing out why we need to defend Assange on some level or another.
Yeah, and I have the quote here. I'll go ahead and read it just so that people have something positive to end on. In courageously upholding political beliefs that most of us profess to share, he, and he is Julian Assange, has performed an enormous service to all those in the world who treasure the values of freedom and democracy and who therefore demand the right to know what their elected representatives are doing. So Julian Assange's positive impact on the world is undeniable. And yeah, we don't know for sure if Noam, who's 91 years old, is going to be traveling to the UK to testify, but it seems like it's a possibility.
And he also noted, I like the dig he got in at the end, the hostility it has provoked from the Trump administration is equally undeniable, and I think he's right about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was keeping it positive, so I left that out. But
fair enough. Anyways, if you could let my listeners know how they can follow your work and check out Shadowproof.
Yeah, so if you go to Twitter at KGostola, KGostola, you'll be able to follow my reporting. Like I said, there's going to be this upcoming, very important hearing. I'll be there again. We got some time until that happens, but mid-May. First part of June, it's expected to unfold. And you can go to shadowproof.com. I do a weekly show that is connected to this subject, which is the Dissenter Weekly, and it's on YouTube. And I do an update on whistleblower stories from the past week. I started that in December, and my colleague Brian Sonnenstein helps me do this show. We air it live, and then it archives, and we share it around. And I do a podcast called Unauthorized Disclosure. So that's a weekly podcast with my co-host, Rania Kalik. So there's many ways that you can get my reporting. However you would like it, those are the different places you could go to if you want to hear more.
And I just want to note that Shadowproof is, I guess you guys are doing a bit of a fundraising effort right now?
Yeah, we have been asking people to chip in a few bucks if you followed along with my reporting and you appreciate it, or you want to make sure that we are able to get back to London to cover these proceedings in May and June. I think it's critical because while I was there on Thursday, I was one of maybe like three or four other U.S. journalists that had stayed for the fourth day. So we know that U.S. press are going to parachute in, cover maybe one or two days, and then leave, and then come back as they feel like there might be news that's going to break. We're one of the few organizations that's going to be there every single day so people can track it. And I'm going to be doing live tweeting every single day so that people can follow along who aren't in London or the UK. So, yeah, we are asking people if they have just a little bit to give so we can keep our funds, keep things healthy so that we can actually support having somebody overseas to cover this trial, to cover these proceedings, because it is expensive. Everything mounts up pretty quickly, especially when we're talking about international travel. That adds up much more quickly than – I mean, the expenses are – they far surpass what it costs to cover Chelsea Manning's trial in Fort Meade, Maryland.
Well, I would just add to all of that in regards to Shadowproof. I know there's going to be someone out there saying, well, Shadowproof has a progressive slant on things. What if there's a bias? Well, all I can say to the people who would say that is that – Shadowproof, in every fact check I've seen from media fact check websites, rates your reporting as highly factual. And I think Shadowproof is doing great independent journalism. So I want to thank you for all the work you've done with Shadowproof.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll just say quickly that it's biased in the sense that if something happens, we allow it to shape our viewpoints like a normal person should. I think that it's not ideological. We do not have ideological reporting. We don't do partisan reporting at Shadowproof. And so that's why it's able to reach a wide audience and have such an impact.
And as I said, highly, highly factual. Everyone check out Shadowproof. Kevin Gastola, thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
It was good to talk to you. That was great.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kevin Gastola, and I urge you to check out Shadowproof, especially for their podcast Unauthorized Disclosure, hosted by Kevin and his co-host Rania Kalik. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon, where you can hear the Parallax Views current events program of the week that was, as well as some archived editions of the Parallax Views main program. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.